from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli-Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of this year's Winter Magic Fest at the Indie Fringe.
Abracadabra, I'll take a look at what the Phoenix Theater has planned for late winter and spring.
And I'll talk with Richard McCoy about the art scene in Columbus, Indiana, plus there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. It's that magical time of year again. Yep, late January and the annual Inti Fringe Winter Magic Fest. They're back. Travis DiNicola spoke by phone with one of the featured magicians, Suzanne. Suzanne is the first woman to win Close-Up Magician of the Year from the Academy of Magical Arts. And most recently, she fooled Penn and Teller on their trademark TV series, Fool Us.
I am thrilled to chat with you. I'm a fan, and I'm so glad you're coming to the Inti Fringe Winter Magic Fest this year.
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to get me away from the Minnesota winter.
Well, we just had a little bit of snow ourselves here, but I'm sure nothing like what you're dealing with. Yeah, that'd be great if you could make that use that magic to make it all go away, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Hey, so I want to talk about, well, so many things with you and your show and what you've done with when you were on Penn & Teller's Fool Us. But before we jump into all that, it's my understanding that I know you're a cancer survivor and that that really had a lot to do with you choosing to become a professional magician. Is that correct?
Well, I'm actually doing magic prior to that, but I was chasing a part of my career of things that I didn't really care for, but there was a lot of money in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really more doing parts of magic that I didn't really like that much. I started doing magic professionally in 86,
okay,
and I was diagnosed with cancer in 99.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that amount of time. I started doing a lot of trade show work where I was traveling away from my son who was born in 1990,
mm-hmm,
and he didn't really like me leaving that much, but I thought, well, you know, that's what magicians do. They go out and they do trade shows, and
and
I didn't really like trade shows that much, so I wasn't following my bliss is what my motto is follow your bliss. And the things that I liked doing in magic, like restaurant magic and house parties, that's my absolute favorite thing. You don't really make a whole lot of money at it, but boy, you sure can have a lot of fun.
You really connect with your audience a lot more, I'm sure, than you would during a trade show when you're promoting someone else's product.
Right, exactly. And that's what I do magic for. That's the thrill that I get out of it.
So cool. So
the cancer changed my focus in what I really wanted to do, and I figured, you know, if it doesn't bring me joy, then why do it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and obviously you're doing it well because you are the first woman to win the award of Close-Up Magician of the Year from the Academy of Magical Arts, which is so cool. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. It was such an honor, and I still get teary when I think about it because it's truly an honor for me.
Now, was that award given? How is that done? Is that for one specific, like a signature trick, or is it looking at your career or a show, or how does that determine?
It's looking at the show that I did for that particular year.
Mm-hmm.
So I received Close-Up Magician of the Year for 2010. And members come in and they watch your show, and then they kind of hold in there who they liked the best.
Mm-hmm.
And out of all of the people that they saw. And that was also the first year that they put the capability of watching the videos of the performers. So people even outside the castle who don't typically go to the castle,
the Magic Castle,
members,
mm-hmm,
also got to see the performances, and so I had a video up on, so, you know, people in Iowa could vote for me, even if they'd never seen me live.
Right. And the castle you're referring to is the Magic Castle in California.
Oh, yes, right, in Hollywood, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's a member voting, so the general public doesn't vote for it. It's only the members of the Academy of Magical Arts.
Well, that's a great award to get from your peers, then.
Was
The cups and balls part of that performance? Because I know that that's a signature trick of yours.
Right, yeah. I've actually been doing the cups and balls since the first time I worked at the Magic Castle was in 1988. And I did the cups and balls then, but I did it my mentor's version in his patter.
Mm-hmm.
And I still do that physical part of the routine, but I changed the patter, which gives it a completely different feel.
Yeah, I was watching a video of it. I'm a huge cups and balls fan, by the way. And for listeners who aren't maybe quite familiar with it, generally it's three cups and three balls that the balls keep ending up in different places and in different configurations where they shouldn't be, under and above and in the cups and so on. But the way that you do it is it's sort of a story about these travelers.
Right, yeah. Everybody does the cups and balls with I'm going to do this, and now that happened,
mm-hmm.
and now I'm going to do this, and now that happened. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I did want to do something different to stand out a little bit. And
It's one of my favorite tricks, but it's also, I think, a very hard trick to follow for non-magicians, and sometimes audiences are kind of like, wait, was that supposed to happen or not? Your narrative kind of leads, I think, the audience through it quite nicely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it can be a confusing trick, and I think that's a lot of the reason why the basic patter is, I'm going to take this ball, I'm going to make it disappear, and now it ends up under the cup. And that's why the storyline is normally telling you what you're going to do and then showing that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to get away from that as a demonstration, and I wanted to put it more up as an artistic piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely see that. Will you be doing the cups and balls when you're here in Indianapolis, do you know?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm going to do the act that I won Close-Up Magician of the Year with, plus I'm going to add some things because the show I'm going to do is going to be between 45 minutes and an hour,
mm-hmm.
and the show that I do at the castle needs to be capped at 20 minutes.
Sure.
So
sure.
I'm adding a bunch of stuff that I do locally in Minneapolis for private parties.
Now, will you be doing the Band-Aid trick that you fooled Penn and Teller with?
Yes.
Awesome.
I will be doing that one.
So congratulations on winning the big FU award, by the way, for Fooled Us, of course.
Thank you very much. I should bring that with me and
set
it on my table, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to see what it looks like in person. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, it's extremely gaudy, and I think that's what they were going for.
Yeah.
So it's this acrylic gaudy, lovely thing that I have sitting on my piano. So.
Awesome. Well, it's certainly
I'm very proud of it.
Coveted award. I mean, many magicians compete each week on their show and try to fool Penn and Teller, which is a very hard thing to do.
They are pretty smart.
Well, it's amazing to me when I watch that show, and I'm a big fan of that show as well, that, you know, some magicians come on and they're great performers, but, you know, in the end, the show is about, can you actually fool Penn and Teller and not necessarily entertain them? And, you know, often magicians come on with tricks that, you know, have been done other places. And if it's done somewhere else, then certainly Penn and Teller know it, where you brought in a pretty obscure trick and done in kind of a completely different way, if that's correct.
Yes, right, exactly. And actually, it's really more of a hook to get people to watch the show that it's about fooling them.
Mm-hmm.
On it's a layered thing. On some level, it is about fooling them. But we were told by the consultants that, you know, don't worry about it if you don't fool them, because we really just want to put on a good magic show.
Sure.
And so if you don't fool them, don't feel bad. It's not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're on at all is a pretty big deal.
Pardon me?
The fact that you're on the show at all is a pretty big deal.
Oh, right. Yeah. And right. To even be on the list of people, because it was not an audition thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're put on a list by, I know Johnny Thompson and Mike Close were the consultants for it, and they were compiling their own list, and then they had some other magicians, trusted magicians, who were putting people on lists, and then they sort of get together and they go, yeah, this person fits the demographic, because you also have to have to be able to please the network, mm-hmm. and the network wanted a certain demographic, which is between 18 and 30, because mm-hmm. that's who normally watches that. And but what magician are you going to really get between 18 and 30 who has enough chops to be on that show? You'll get some, but you're not going to get, you're not going to have 100 on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they needed to come up with. And I lucked out a little bit. I maybe looked like I could sort of kind of fall into that age range, but I'm actually way out of that age range. But the fact that there aren't very many female magicians,
right.
and then I have some cred behind me with the other award, so that allowed me to stay on the show. But I'm sure that there were a lot of people who didn't make the cut because they didn't fit the demographic.
Hmm. But it must have been awesome to get that invitation to be on the show.
Oh, I was really super excited, and it really got my imaginative creative juices flowing again, because I had been doing that Band-Aid transpo that is actually a trick that Joe Given from Colorado came up with in the 80s or something like that. And I've been doing it since the late 90s with the patter that mm-hmm. you saw on there. Because being a mom, you know, that it really fit for me that's what Band-Aids are for.
Sure.
Is for
the kids' boobers.
It's right, exactly. And so that turned into also one of my signature pieces along with the cuffs and ball. But when I initially showed it to Johnny Thompson thinking, well, this is a very obscure thing, he went, oh, yeah, it's a neat trick, but that one part right there, you got to take that part out.
Hmm.
And it was basically he was seeing the method. And I went, well, I can't take that out. That's how the trick works. And he said, oh, they're going to know what you did
mm-hmm.
right away. So change that. Now, he didn't give me any ideas on how to change it.
Okay.
So that gave me an opportunity to really do some thinking and some creative problem solving. And it was extremely fun. And I will never go back to doing it the way that I did it before.
Really?
Because the way that I'm doing it now is way more deceptive. The way I did it before would fool, like, lay people and everything, and that's great. Mm-hmm. But now magicians are going, what the heck are you doing?
Well, it had to be pretty cool when Teller came up on stage with his notebook, guessing at how you had done it, and you shook him off and said, no, that's not how I did it.
Right, yeah, right. Yep.
So does this mean you get to go back to Vegas and perform with Penn & Teller? Is that part of winning?
I already did. I already got my prize. So the prize was you got to be on their stage
mm-hmm.
For one night in front of their audience of, I think there's like 1,500 or 2,000 people in their audience.
Sure.
And then you get mm-hmm. to be on their stage alongside them and it was fantastic. And then you got to go backstage and chat with them for a while, and it was really great. I seriously enjoyed myself.
What a cool experience!
And
yeah,
it was really very cool. And for somebody who went to college to be a computer programmer, and that's actually what my job was going to be, and somebody who never really thought, oh, I'm going to be a magician.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is Everything is gravy at this point. So.
That's pretty nice to hear. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, now, have you been to Indianapolis before?
I think I've been to Indianapolis. I grew up in Michigan, so,
okay.
You know, you're close enough that
mm-hmm.
I've been there for some other reasons, probably visiting people, but I've never done the...
But we've never seen you perform here.
No, I didn't even start performing magic until the mm-hmm. early 80s. So, yeah, I've never performed there, no.
Good. Well, we are looking forward greatly to having you at the Winter Magic Fest. It's always such a great long weekend and some terrific magicians locally and then from around the country who participate in it. And it's going to be awesome having you here as well this year, Suzanne.
Well, thank you. I'm so excited about coming, and it sounds like it's just going to be one big party. So
a very magical party.
Travis DiNicola with the magician Suzanne. You can see her and many other magicians during the 6th annual Indie Fringe Winter Magic Festival, which runs from Thursday, January 21st through Sunday, January 24th at the Indie Fringe Basile and Indie 11 Theaters in downtown Indianapolis. Find all you need to know, including individual showtimes and dates, ticket pricing and purchasing, and parking information at IndieFringe.org, IndieFringe.org.
The Phoenix Theater's producing director, Brian Fonseca, and playwright-in-residence, Tom Horan, popped into our studios to give us a sneak peek at the second half of their season, which runs through August.
All right, so Butler's up and on its feet now, and what do you think? You still very happy you chose it?
Oh, my gosh, yes. It's just so topical. You know, when at the time that we chose it, what was in the news last year was all of the controversy over the Confederate flag.
Mm, that's right.
And people trying to understand why are some people upset when it's a symbol of this rather than a symbol of that. Well, come see Butler, and it'll tell you exactly what it's a symbol of. But what I really like about the play, it's both challenging but funny. I mean, it's socially right on point. There is dialogue in the play that seems to be lifted from the Black Lives Matter movement, and yet it's very appropriate to the time that the play is taking place.
Mm. And at the crux of it, our Civil War officer was
William Butler.
Yeah, and was an attorney before.
Who was an attorney before he was given this post. And as an attorney rather than a military man, at the beginning of the Civil War, Lincoln was going to honor the law of the land, which was to return any slaves to their owners. But Butler crafted language and found a loophole in the law, because he was a lawyer, mm-hmm. that changed the course of the lives of many, many slaves and consequently the war, because slaves were being used to build armaments, to fortify the armaments. And so as such, they were really fighting, forced to fight in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he, using that knowledge, he found a way around that law.
Well, the layers of moral complexity in there are just stunning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is. And it is so contemporary, even to the point that Mallory, the slave who showed up at this northern post, is asked by Butler, are all Negroes like you? Which is very contemporary to the idea of, you
sure.
know, African-Americans being forced to try to answer as a race,
right.
as opposed to an individual.
Right.
And in the course of the play, you realize both Butler and Mallory are absolutely unique, as we all are.
Yeah. And what you studied in history books is generalizations, and you've got to go way beyond that.
Absolutely.
This feels like it's right in the wheelhouse of the Phoenix Mission, you know?
You know, somehow we get really lucky on occasions when we're choosing plays, because you have to understand we're choosing them about a year many times before they're actually produced, and sometimes they actually hit spot on with what's mm-hmm. going on around us. I think we might have spoken about this last time when we produced Tom's play on Typhoid Mary,
mm-hmm.
right as the Ebola virus was in the headlines and everybody was panicked about what does that mean. And then there was all of the dialogue once again about individual rights versus the safety of a community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think what makes these very Phoenix plays is they're tackling heavy subjects and serious subjects with intellect, but also, as Brian said, lots of humor, so entertaining. I think we cannot say that enough, that anyone who may feel daunted by the subject matter, I suggest take a chance on it, because these characters are so surprising. And I feel like that's something we look for in all the plays that are happening at
the Phoenix. You don't want actors preaching to the audience.
Oh, no.
You
want to
draw people in with entertainment. I gather, a little bit lighter note, pulp, not that there isn't humor in Butler, but pulp, kind of corny?
We'd like to say stylish.
Stylish, okay.
Very film noir. But no,
compliment.
Actually, no. We are going to have a lot of fun with it, and it's a little less issue oriented.
What's
than
it about?
The others, but it's just a fun diversion for us all, and it's really at the heart of the theme of the season, which is all about mystery,
mm-hmm.
and it's a look at the great suspense movies, the film noir series starting like in the 30s. Think the Maltese Falcon, all the way through whatever happened to Jessica Rabbit? Who framed Jessica Rabbit?
Yes, yeah.
Roger Rabbit, sorry.
Roger, yeah. One of those
Roger bodies. Rabbit. Yeah. And even Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Steve Martin film.
I mean, it has that kind of fun and flair, and yet really pays attention to the details of the characteristics of the film noir series.
And you're actually showing a screening of Maltese Falcon so people can kind of remember that fun vocabulary and that stylized way of presenting, right?
We are, and we hope to capture a lot of the technical aspects of that film as well.
How do you do that?
The lighting and the costumes,
okay.
and the style in which actors present lines. But beyond that, pulp also looks at it's a murder mystery centered around four pulp writers, each specializing in a different genre, romance, action, adventure, sci-fi, and horror.
Ooh.
And a critic has been killed.
Uh-oh.
That sets off the play. And a gumshoe, down on his luck, is hired by the beautiful femme fatale to come in and try to solve the mystery.
And the playwright's done a wonderful job of letting the play sort of bend to each genre as each author is in a scene.
I already have a bet on who done it, but I'm not going to say anything. So it's set in the 30s. So are you directing this?
I'm directing this. And that's one of the great things about the job is that not only do I get to choose the plays, which ones I want to direct, and it just seemed like a really fun project for me, especially coming off The Nether, which was so wonderfully dark and very intense and very complex. So this is just a real wonderful contrast for me to have fun.
Are you watching some of the noir films to kind of get in the groove?
We all are. Our customer has a film library of 50, 60 titles and is sharing them all.
Whoa.
I know this is a little bit out of that particular period, but you know my favorite film is The Third Man,
mm-hmm.
the Orson Welles. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't an Orson Welles directed film. He was just an actor on that project, but had a lot of his players in it and just had his sensibility. So, yeah, that's a fun time. It's just to spend time just looking back at those movies.
Yeah, cool. And now for something completely different, one of the newest Stephen Dietz scripts, On Clover Road. This sounds kind of harrowing.
Yeah, and he is such a hot writer right now, but I'm going to let Tom talk about it because Tom has a personal history with Mr. Dietz, who we really admire as a writer.
Oh, have you studied
with
him?
Yeah, I studied with Stephen Dietz down in Austin, he's so amazing with dialogue and tension and surprise. Many of you may be familiar with, he's written a number of plays that have been done at the Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I heard he was doing a thriller, I was in,
mm-hmm.
right? And this one takes place in sort of an away motel. And there is a woman who's looking for her daughter who left years ago, essentially captured by a cult.
Mm.
And she's working with a deprogrammer to kidnap her daughter back and essentially get her daughter back. So there's this lovely sort of surprise as you try to figure out who these people are, what exactly has happened. And at the heart of it, there is this mother and daughter reunion that I think is heartfelt, and it says a lot about the relationship between children and parents.
The daughter's an adult, right?
The daughter, like 18, right? And so what the daughter owes to her mother and what the mother owes to her daughter and them trying to find some reconciliation.
Well, and also something kind of ripped from the headlines, not just in the literal sense of an individual being kidnapped and pulled into a different way of thinking, but sometimes sort of wholesale people trying to lead whole groups of people away and change their thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Once again, about a year ago, there were headlines about the woman that was finally found or released in California, reunited with her family. And you wonder, wow, how do you – what are those moments like when you first start having a conversation with someone you've either chosen to leave or were kidnapped?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you begin reconciliation? So it's a really fascinating piece.
Yeah.
And we have a top-notch cast, best cast in the city. You know, Bill Simmons, Rob and Jen Johansson as our three leads. It just couldn't be stronger character actors to pull this off, and that's exactly what we need.
Wow.
And
cool.
We have Courtney Sale, who directed Mr. Burns last season, mm-hmm. is working on that play. And she also studied with Stephen Dietz with me.
Oh, wow.
And there's something interesting about that, because I think that as artists, when you work with somebody, especially in a position of, you know, like teacher, then student, and then colleague, that you've created a dialogue and you know each other's work in such an interesting way that these are the perfect interpreters for this piece for us.
Right. You speak that language. Mm-hmm. You have that vocabulary in you.
It'll be in the downstairs space of the theater, too, which is going to be perfect for that sort of thriller
atmosphere. Claustrophobic, what's going to happen next, and is anybody standing behind me kind of feeling.
Exactly.
Wow. And then your annual bilingual production, Leyenda, you two are co-creating this with interviews with Hispanic and Latino folks from our communities.
That is correct. And really, I'll let Tom talk about the structure somewhat, but it's going to combine elements of storytelling and dance and music.
Ooh.
And different ways to interpret and tell stories.
Hmm.
What I think Brian's done in such an excellent way over the course of Phoenix's years is try to give voice to different communities. And I like being a playwright in residence at the Phoenix because it allows me to be a playwright in service of. So I feel like I have a different relationship to this show and how I can help first listen to a lot of people tell their stories and the stories that were important to them growing up and what those stories might mean now. We're looking at Latin American folk tales. And so we've interviewed a number of community members telling us what stories they remember. And we're sort of weaving them all together in an evening. And as Brian said, there'll be text and there'll be story, but there'll also be dance and the song. So it'll be quite an event, I think.
How beautiful. Wow.
And family-oriented.
Right.
You know, that's no strong language, no sexual subject matters. So feel free to bring the kids.
Not something you always get to say at the Phoenix.
That's true.
That's okay.
That's so true.
You might not want to bring kids to Book of Mormon, not for any naughty reason, but just because I think the humor is pretty kind of a sophisticated.
It is somewhat, and it sounds like, you know, when I went to see it in Chicago, I thought, oh, it's going to be just a parody, somewhat of the Book of Mormon, and they threw in Ethel Merman, and it's just this, you know, kind of kitsch kind of production.
Like an extended joke?
Yes. And I was really worried that that's what we were going to see. But actually, it does have its own story, its own arc, and its own heart. And I think at the center of it, there's something really wonderful, warm, and complex to hold on to. And it's all about identity and being able to be comfortable with who you are. So at the center of the play, the mystery is the Mormons missionaries knock on a door and a woman claiming to be Ethel Merman answers. So right there, you know, it's like, oh, this is going to be goofy. But then she actually wins you over, and her message really is you come away with, if that's who she wants to be and is comfortable being, what is the harm?
Hmm.
She found a way to fit in and work herself into the world around her. And they, too, learn lessons about being who they are and true to their own identities as well.
And People with Complex Identities leads us directly to Dr. John C. Lilly, right? Acidophen experiment, which has had an evolution over the last couple of years. It might have been at one time you were kind of going in the direction of making it a musical. Now it's a straight play.
Yeah. And I think one of the luxuries I've been afforded is to have the resources of actors and directors and the guidance of Bryden to help develop this play.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't know who John C. Lilly is, he was an actual man who existed. He was a scientist, did some work in like the 40s and 50s. He's known for, I like to say, three things. He invented the isolation chamber, so the sensory deprivation tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did experiments trying to speak to dolphins and have dolphins speak to him. And then he did a lot of experiments using LSD. And then he would often combine those interests in various ways, including doing things like giving acid to dolphins.
That is a very big life to try to pull into a play. I wish you luck as you keep rewriting.
Sharon Gamble with Phoenix Theater producing director Brian Fonseca and playwright in residence Tom Horan. The theater's current production, Butler, runs through February 7th. Learn more about this topical and timely Civil War drama and the rest of the season at phoenixtheater.org. Again, phoenixtheater.org. That's theater with an R-E at the end.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Many people will have a 3-day weekend.
That's true.
For participating in arts events coming up. So we have a lot of suggestions in our calendar. We call
What do we do? I know we just had a holiday, but it's like two whole weeks of working 5 days a week.
I know, right?
Hey, so a lot of things going on Martin Luther King Day around the city, including at the IMA. It's their community day from 1 to 4 at the museum. It's free, but you can make a suggested donation to the Martin Luther King Community Center. And they're celebrating the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King that day in partnership with Old Soul Entertainment, and there they have an afternoon filled with written, spoken, and interactive expressions of love in the galleries. And Department of Public Works, an Indianapolis-based organization, is going to be doing a whole bunch of cool things in public space with art and public speaking and leading different activities that are going to be going on all afternoon. You can take a look at a full list of all the events at the IMA's website or just show up between 1 and 4 on Monday.
Sound like great celebrations appropriate for MLK Day. Love that.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to get your strength up before you attend such events, you might consider going to the Indiana State Fairgrounds this weekend, Saturday 11 to 6, Sunday 11 to 6, for Indiana's largest food and beverage event. It's called Fantastic Food Fest. It's a weekend full of food, fun, and entertainment, and some of the featured celebrities include Indiana's own Ted Allen, author and host of Food Network's Chopped, as well as, do you know about the Butcher Babe?
Oh, I've heard about her, yeah.
Marielle
Gavin,
the Butcher Babe. Mm-hmm. She is, she's kind of sassy, and she's going to be there, and demonstrations include top chefs including Brad Gates, Regina Mihalik, and as they say, many, many more. So it's Fantastic Food Fest, and you can find out more at fantasticfoodfest.com.
That sounds fun.
Yeah.
Butcher Babe, she definitely has her chops.
Oh, no. There's never a percussionist around when you need one for the...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
More things going on MLK Day on Monday at the Indiana State Museum. They're going to be open, and admission is free for each canned good donated to Gleaners Food Bank. So bring a can of food to donate, and you can get in free from 10 to 5. They're doing, having the videos of the speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King that are going to be playing throughout the day in the Legacy Theater. And then there's a whole bunch of other activities, including different craft activities for kids and the Discovery Playground and a whole bunch more things going on for kids. But also, and this is really cool, Sharon, that I'm really excited about, the State Museum just announced that they are extending the run of their pop-up video arcade that they had going on just through the holidays.
Fun.
Originally, it was supposed to close right after New Year's, and now it's going to be open through May 1st, where they have this huge retro arcade with a bunch of cool both old video games and some pinball games as well at the State Museum.
Miss Pac-Man!
Yes!
Now that's really old school. Hey, so MLK Day weekend would be a fine time to check out the new Richard Strand play at the Phoenix Theater. It's called Butler, and it's a fascinating exploration of how we think about the roles of different cultures in the United States. The story is actually set during the Civil War, but it's a surprisingly contemporary look at how we talk to each other. You can find out more about that at phoenixtheater.org. You just heard about that.
Very cool. Hey, this weekend at the Central Library in the Learning Curve, the Hot Jazz for Cool Kids series kicks off again for jazz on Sunday afternoons with the Rob Dixon Quartet playing at 3 o'clock. This is a free concert, and it's the first of three different concerts that they're going to be having on Sunday afternoons for kids in the Discovery, the Learning Curve at the Central Library.
Nice. Get the kids out and expose them to some good music early. Yeah. Hey, you'll hear more about the Indie Folk Series next week on our show, but when I talked to the Indie Folk Series guys recently, I confirmed that Irish Arts Indie concert this Saturday night, which is billed as a lively evening of traditional Irish Irish music, language, stories, and song. I suspected that there might be audience participation, and the guys from Indie Folk basically said, there's no way we could stop that. It's an Irish music night. So check that out and find out more at indiefolkseries.org. That's this Saturday night. Irish music.
Sounds good. Next Sunday, January 24th, 4 o'clock at the Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Carmel, the Fine Arts Series is presenting Four on the Floor String Quartets. Great name. It's a local string ensemble including Butler's Larry Shapiro and Anderson Symphony Concertmaster Byron Plexico, and they'll then be performing a bunch of standards from string quartet repertoire as well as some classical favorites. Should be a lot of fun. 4 o'clock at the Pilgrim Lutheran Church.
I can't wait to see the stick shift cello in that quartet.
Right.
I might
Excellent.
Have to check that out. More music coming up on January 31st at 6 p.m. That is a Sunday. The Icarus Jazz Ensemble is presenting a free concert at St. Paul's Church. St. Paul's Church, and they, if you've not heard Icarus Ensemble, they play an eclectic mix of classical, jazz, pop, and original compositions, and they have a CD, which you can learn more about at CD Baby. Just type in Icarus, like the guy who flew too close to the sun with the wax wings. Mm. Anyway, that concert, once again, is coming up at 6 p.m. on Sunday the 31st at St. Paul's.
Here's something to plan ahead for. The Warehouse in Carmel is bringing in Ricky Lee Jones.
Whoa!
Yeah, on Friday, March 4th. An intimate evening with Ricky Lee Jones, two-time Grammy Award winner, and I saw her perform once in California about 20 years ago. What an amazing concert. I was even a fan. It was a buddy of mine that was a fan. It's like, oh, we got to go see the show.
Yeah.
And what a great show. I still remember it just being pretty fantastic. So
cool.
She is going to be performing, and there's premiere seating and central seating, reserve seating, and all different types that you can find out about if you get more information. If you go onto the Warehouse's website online and look for Ricky Lee Jones, but it is going to be very, 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 very small, intimate concert, and it's almost already sold out, but it sounds like it'd be a great show Friday, March 4th.
Run to your computer and see if you can score some tickets. Hey, more planning ahead on Saturday the 30th and Sunday the 31st at 7:30 and 2:30, respectively, at the Schrott Center for the Arts at Butler University. Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra presenting a concert called Opera's Rising Stars. So you can hear the Metropolitan Opera National Council selectees, some fabulous young voices that you will surely be hearing more about later.
And you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis' Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us next weekend on the calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Landmark Columbus is a new organization dedicated to caring for and celebrating the world-renowned design heritage in Columbus, Indiana. Travis DiNicola spoke with director Richard McCoy to learn more.
Richard, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Hey, Travis. Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You are very welcome, and Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year. There's lots of great things to do in 2016.
Yeah, absolutely, including visit Columbus, because there's always cool stuff going on down in Columbus, Indiana. I mean, you know, it's a city that's known for just amazing architecture, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But you're the director of a new organization that I just heard about, I mean, maybe a month ago, called Landmark Columbus. Tell me what this is. I mean, it's kind of a new partnership between a lot of different entities, right, that want to promote Columbus?
It's an organization that just came to be late last year. It's a program of Heritage Fund, mm-hmm. the Community Foundation of Bartholomew County. And it's a program that's dedicated to caring for and celebrating the world-renowned design heritage of Columbus, Indiana. I'm really happy to be here talking about it today in Indianapolis because I think, you know, the more and more I work and learn about Columbus and its connections to Indianapolis, I think these two cities are a little more tied together than we think about all the time. So mm-hmm. I'm glad to be here on WFYI.
Well, you know, I mean, Columbus is not that far away, obviously. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you can get down there in 45 minutes or so, you know, depending. And, you know, and it does have this amazing architectural history. Let's talk a little bit about that, because that really wouldn't exist without Cummins and of course, and the Miller family.
Right. So, you know, the history of Columbus and its design heritage and all of the great architecture there really goes back to J. Irwin Miller, the man who, after World War II, ran Cummins and started a new program there through the Cummins Foundation to create a program to help the community build great buildings that really worked well for the community. And one of the things that I really like about Columbus is that from the outside, you think it's a place that has really great architecture that's visually interesting to look at and really exciting. But once you get to know the community a little better, you know that architecture was always used as a way to solve a problem. And so, you know, in the 60s, you know, they were trying to build schools that were of great value. And so they hired the best designers to come and build schools. And so it's just as much a story of a community working in partnership than it is a community we're always working to build interesting buildings.
How do you think that has affected Columbus as a community? I mean, it's still a fairly small town.
Right. Well, so Columbus is a town of about 45,000, and it's a city, but it still feels like a small town. It's a city that works together really well, and it's a city that has proven that if it works together, great things will happen. And so there's some, you know, there's all sorts of data that shows that Columbus is a great place to live. From the average income to the kinds of jobs to the great education to the city parks. There's all sorts of reasons why Columbus is great. And so all the community has to do is look back at the work it's done in the past to realize it has a method to work together and an incentive to work together. And so I think Columbus really shows how a community of its size can be the best it can.
This is more than just looking back, though. I mean, Columbus has had a visitor center for years with some great artwork in it, some Dale Chihuly. And you can always, of course, go on architectural tours when you're down there or visit the IMA's Miller House. But I get the impression that this work that you're doing with Landmark Columbus and these new partnerships, it's also about celebrating and maybe even creating new sort of opportunities and events and what have you.
Well, yeah. So Landmark Columbus is a kind of 21st century preservation organization. We don't usually talk about the word preservation in Columbus because it's not an effort to sort of mothball the buildings that are there. It's an mm-hmm. effort to continue the traditions that help build them. And so in this way, we have three core goals. One, we want to physically care for the landmark projects that are there. Two, we want to raise public awareness about the design heritage and the history of what makes that community so great. And then also we want to engage excellent designers to create new buildings in the future. And so this is why it's sort of a different take on things. You know, in order for Columbus to be, quote, preserved, it has to continue doing the things it's always done.
Yeah, it's not done yet. This is not just past tense, right?
That's right. It's a really very future-looking organization. And so we've been working for the past year on some really exciting things that we're going to be talking about later this year, some ways to get new designers interested in Columbus. So that's a bit of a teaser.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about that. How did you get involved with this? I mean, Richard, you've been kind of working behind the scenes with a number of different arts organizations and efforts over the years. Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you ended up working on this project with Columbus.
Well, thanks. You know, I left Indiana after going to undergrad in Bloomington in 1998, never to return. And India, no place. And my wife and I got married, and we lived in Europe for a little while, and then I went to graduate school in New York, and we thought we were going to be there for a long time, but we started having kids and decided to come back to Indianapolis, where I worked at the IMA for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this really great opportunity to work out of the mayor's office in Columbus to help the city start to think about creating a process or a plan to care for its landmarks. And so this was a really great opportunity that then we transitioned out of City Hall into the Community Foundation, which is probably a little more of a natural fit in Columbus. And so, you know, my background is in conservation and restoration of large-scale public artworks and contemporary works. And so this, to me, was a little bit of a transition, but, you know, I felt like it was a very natural thing. I had studied architecture in graduate school and large-scale things, so it was an exciting opportunity. You know, I would argue the best opportunity in the state. So
that's pretty cool. A great thing for you to land into, come into. And when you're talking about, you know, preservation of, you know, public art, I mean, architecture is art as well. I mean, it's buildings that are art that we live in, you know, some people say. So that's sort of a natural transition. But there is something even, I don't know, maybe even more special about what's happening, I think, in Columbus that maybe, you know, some people aren't aware of in Indianapolis.
Yeah. You know, I don't think enough people really know about Columbus, even in Indianapolis, don't really understand sort of the history and the intentions behind some of the things in the community. But I think it is becoming more well-known, certainly with the IMA's acquisition of the Miller House and Garden, that fantastic home built by Eero Saarinen in 1957. You know, it's a remarkable sort of time capsule to go back to and to see that in Columbus. But just as much today, I think this notion of, quote, design is now a thing that we're talking a lot about in the 21st century. And, you know, there's no better place in the state of Indiana to go look at how architecture fits in with public art and interior design and landscape architecture, all under this sort of big umbrella of design. And there's no better place to look at that than in Columbus. Head down Fifth Street and go look at the Bartholomew County Public Library, which was built by I.M. Pei with a monumental Henry Moore out front.
I was just going to say, what's a good place to start? That sounds like a perfect place right there.
Well, you know, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about public art because I love it so much. But, you know, I'd argue that Columbus has two of the state's best five public artworks.
Hmm.
And maybe, and so to me, I would
rank. Moore is one of them?
What's that? Yeah, certainly. So Henry Moore's mm-hmm. large arch, and then kind of a little known piece inside the Commons, which is Jean Tongley's Chaos from 1974.
That crazy machine.
I love that thing. But yeah, there's the best place to start is on Fifth Street. Stop in and see the visitor center. Say hi to our friends in there. Jan Bannister will connect you to a great tour around the city, either by walking or on a bus. And from there, you can also take a special guided tour of the Miller House.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's you can really get it all from 5th and Franklin.
Hey, I just heard about a new documentary that's being made later this year about one of the architects from Columbus. Now, is that something that your organization is involved with at all? Or
yeah, that's the documentary that's on Kevin Roche, John Dinkaloo and Associates. And yeah, we're looking forward to that. We're not quite sort of all the plans, but you know, there's always interest in Columbus on a national level. I think more than perhaps people realize, and
mm-hmm.
just. Late last summer, there was the Saarinen family is working on a documentary about Eero Saarinen's work. And so, you know, when these kind of opportunities come up, Columbus really shows its best and helps out in every way it can. So no doubt we'll have some small role in that. But, yeah.
Hey, before I let you go, you said that you were talking about two pieces of work, the Tingley and the Moor, that are great public artworks. But you also mentioned that you've got a couple other favorites. And as someone who specializes in public art, I'm curious what they are here in Indiana for you.
Oh, I love these. I love making lists. I love trying to figure out what's the best. Not really for any definitive reason, but just try to figure out. I love to try to figure out what are the best modern buildings in Indianapolis. What are the best modern buildings in the state? What's the best public art? It's not that I'm a snob. I just love to that kind of mental exercise. And so I think I would probably rank the top four public artworks in the state of Indiana. It's, you know, you have to start with Love, right?
Of course.
And then from there, I think it's really a tie between Henry Moore and the Large Arch and the Jean Tongley and Columbus. And then my fourth is probably Calder, the Calder that's out in front of the Musical Arts Center in Bloomington. And so things get a lot smaller. The scale gets smaller. There are a few communities that have monumental pieces that really are relevant on a national level. And so in this same way, I don't know, it's interesting. I wonder if your listeners would have an idea of the top five best modern buildings in Indiana.
It sounds like you do.
Yeah, but I'm not going to share that today.
Well, we'll come back for more later. Hey, Richard, always a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks so much for coming in to Art of the Matter today.
Thanks so much for having me, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Landmark Columbus Director Richard McCoy. To learn more about this new organization and what's going on in Columbus, Indiana, visit landmarkcolumbus.org. Again, landmarkcolumbus.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll get a preview of what Indie Folk Series has planned for this spring.
I'll talk with author Larry Swayze about his latest mystery.
And I'll chat with author Abe Amador about his new novel. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.